Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration is the second one from The Coming of the King of the Britons, written by Simon of Kent, and apparently inspired by Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain. The hard fact is that the British and European people face a battle like never before, a battle which is not, as of the past, a brother's war, but a crusade spiritual and temporal against the all-powerful goblins who now own and control every major asset of ours and every Western nation, who possess, along with control of the entire political and intellectual class, the forces of law and war, of church and state, who have seized every channel of knowledge and information and turned it into a yellow sewer from which to poison and drown the souls of the people, which venomous tribe, having cast down all our island borders, which God created with the sea, have brought forth a giant concourse from the south, through which pours the flotsam and jetsam of the barbarian nations into the bosom of our holy land. My beloved sons, know in your hearts that our dear land of Albion, bequeathed to us by God, as the most fair of all islands, most shining jewel in the sea, most furnished with every need, is under the most deadly of occupations. Our people are in mortal danger, as never before, not of some period of battle, at the hands of our own European cousins, playing that game of thrones which marked the ages of war, but of a deadly, murderous extermination plan to finish us off altogether, and to steal everything we have, using barbarians to undertake that task. Barbarians who long to murder, rape and torture us in every conceivable manner, and who say all that was ours is now rightfully theirs, because the goblins have told them we stole it all from them. Up until a few short years ago, there was still the illusion of the possibility of a political solution. But those who have wrestled with this traitorous Westminster clique know well that the regime would rather reduce the nation to ashes with nuclear bombs than even concede one little whit to the patriotic nationalist demands. The whole so-called democratic system was seen for the lie it was after the Brexit vote. In their hearts, the people, and it was the indigenous people who overwhelmingly voted to leave, were clearly demanding an end to immigration and a start to repatriation. But the government claimed non-white immigration, a subject which was forbidden to even discuss during the campaign, was not even an issue in that campaign, and they had every intention to continue pouring in the Third World just as before, with perhaps the generous concession of limiting white immigration. Meanwhile, the independence we sought is to be so neutered that it is no independence at all. The vampire grip of the transnational goblin will not ease an inch on our throats as a result of what Brexit has become. Anyone who believes that somehow the British people will wake up and, using the democratic process, restore an indigenous white Britain, are criminally fooling themselves, misleading the people, and leading us to certain ruin. The political door is, and always was, and always will be, firmly closed in our face, and will remain so, regardless of who wins any election, because, as Sir Oswald Mosley pointed out well over half a century ago, the political parties and their leaders do not control this country. This focus on civil war does not, of course, mean that the pursuit of the political is not one vital plank of the campaign. All rivulets flowing to the one stream, just as a thousand flowers of different nationalist organisations and groups bloom along the sides of the path that leads to one united harvest for war. It may be noted that it will be those who have taken part in politics and local government to the greatest extent, often in a long and worthy service to our people, who will be the wisest counsel upon how to improve the way in which local concerns and the concerns of the common man can be properly heard and acted upon in future, locally and nationally, when we have taken power back from the occupiers. Every nationalist man, even the pacifist, the coward, and the downright villain, will surely rise to the occasion on the day of the flagrante bello. For good and bad, strong and weak, we all dearly wish for the same end. Even the traitors of the past among us may be found with the blood of our enemies smeared on their faces on that day of battle, when all past misdeeds are up for forgiveness, should each man do his duty. I have privileged you, by keeping you away from the world, to remain of a purity of soul and mind that will allow you to do what hardly any man can do in this age of materialist consciousness, to be so untainted by the matrix outside, so still in touch with your real being, that you are enabled to make contact with our ancients and bring forth a message from them to those among us who will to warrior for our liberation and for the saving of our race, our civilization, our nation, the future of our white children, and our long-lost faith, for which we must dedicate ourselves to restore. Even if that battle, when won upon our shores, must spread all the way to Rome and Constantinople in order to secure and restore the borders of the lands of our people. Go now to every great city in Britain, one by one, and behold it, for the depth of the crisis and threat may be so fully known in your hearts that in one flash of communication it can be conveyed to whichever of our great ancestors God will permit to speak to you from heaven, and who will impart to you through prophecy the way forward for those patriotic men who appear to the public to sleep, but in truth are fully awake and armed in their own minds, awaiting the chance to strike for our freedom, that our treasure may be restored. Such men know who they are, for their mark is that they walk with imaginary swords girded to their belts, with imaginary rifles in their hands, and with a thirst for the slaughter of the traitors that gnaws at their foreheads and invades their senses every hour of the day and night when they are awake. Such men cannot observe the Thames without wishing it to run red with the blood of the tyrants, nor any lamppost in Westminster or Whitehall that they will not envision hanging with the perpetrators of the regime. And so our godly youths set out. They travelled through a strange and changed landscape, made up of the vile architecture and brutal landscaping of the age of the goblin. They beheld monstrous structures which towered in vulgar hideousness over the beautiful buildings of the past, or what little in many cases remained of them, and that little often abused with graffiti, modern signage, or ugly new brutal frontage. And they observed how the people were dressed in clothing designed by the goblins, and how the males were emasculated, hairless and thin, like eternally young boys who would never grow to manhood. They did not run and jump and wrestle with one another, as boys always did, but were subdued, weedy, and submissive. They saw that far too many young women were degraded like half-dressed whores, half-naked above, while decked in men's trousers below, unhappy, masculinized, childless, torn from their roots in the household, sent out to work in men's professions, acting irrationally, outside any sensible moral and social control, by any proper authority, such as their fathers or brothers or ministers, fornicating like dogs in the street with black savages, despised and looked down upon as mere bags of garbage by the Islamic invaders who pass among them. And yet those maidens of Britain, who had not been seduced by the state program of creating from an early age through the use of psychology and auto-suggestion, a large, demented class of lesbians or sluts, were still the fairest of the fair. There was hardly in the whole length and breadth of Britain a single female of the other races that could hold a candle to the perfect white British maiden. And had such a maiden adorned herself with the jewellery of modesty, goodness, piety, truth, humility, submission, and femininity, she would have turned every head in the land in admiration, and may, by the grace of God and the swords of our warriors, do so once again. To add to our woes, the brown men lust after our women and children in the most bestial way, egged on by the goblins of the advertising, television and film world, who almost every minute of the day present them as their natural companions and their rightful booty as the invader. Our girls are daily defiled whenever these brutes find them alone or hunt them down in little frequented places. In the case of attacks by these invaders, such women have little recourse to the protection of the law or the judiciary. But what most astonished and depressed the young men was to see that many of their once great cities were now overtaken by ugly, often vile-smelling and aggressive barbarian hordes to whom those conurbations had no cultural relevance or any meaning or attachment, or aroused in them any desire for preservation or improvement, whose historic buildings did not draw any admiration from them, nor convey any story of their builders and founders, and the history thereof, which now fall into disrepair, demolition, or are torched by the rioting invaders who hate our oldest and most cherished buildings the most. And so many beautiful Gothic churches have now been turned into mosques, testament to the war on Christ, long waged against the people by the goblin media and the Marxist clerics. The hatred and contempt of the colonists for the British people, who pass them courteously and peacefully in the street, is only matched in intensity by the Jesus-minded love and seemingly endless compassion and forgiveness of the foolish, welcoming Britons towards them. These invaders care not one whit for the traditions, sensibilities, culture, manners, customs, and way of life of our folk. Rather, they busy themselves, with the aid of the regime, in setting up their own countries within our borders, while importing their own people wholesale from abroad, with every excuse provided to them by the goblins. One little Eastern boy even claimed to our intrepid adventurers that the most English city of Bradford was now an island of Pakistan. Universally it seemed to our travellers that the more love and Christian kindness the Britons showered upon the migrants, the more they were held in contempt by them for doing so, partly because the interlopers regarded them as insane. For who would willingly end the life of his own nation and people for the comfort of others, grovel to them, and give them everything his ancestors had wrought as the inheritance for his own folk? But also because they themselves, as foreigners, even if they had been born here, could not honestly share such feelings. Only the holder of the value could grant it, and the receiver was a beggar by default, an unhappy beggar, for being the recipient of charity, yet also one who was being told on a daily basis by the regime that all he was receiving at the cost of others had in fact originally been stolen from himself. Romulus and Remus had wound their way through the housing estates of the working class of several great metropoli, observing how the authorities, police, and council workers were cool, uncaring, condescending, and often rude to the poor white inhabitants, but broke into clearly insanely smarmy smiles of tender concern whenever dealing with the demands of the invaders, who were always the greatest priority to please and appease. Should any state housing arise, it would be the brown people who would be afforded the accommodation before the indigenous people, even if these settlers had only just set foot on the shore that very week, while the inhabitants had remained on waiting lists in damp squalor for years. They also noted that the police were fastidious in covering up the multitudes of crimes committed by the invaders on a daily basis. A Briton who complained that his daughter had been raped by a migrant was told that he would be charged with a racial hate crime if he persisted in his claim. This after a call by the local imam to the area chief constable. Yet should a Briton commit even the smallest offence, he could well have his door broken down, and should the offence be one of angry words against the invader, he might be thrown in prison by a kangaroo court on the most specious of grounds for the longest of periods. Such is the cruel reign of the goblin over the defeated British people, a noble nation who were fooled by the lies of the occupiers into fighting two world wars against their own race and themselves. The British people of today, who have done nothing but good to the invaders, even to the point of becoming financially ruined and having their pensions robbed to pay for their import and upkeep, are forced to shoulder a false guilt of original sin inherited by them from their forefathers, a penalty which indebits them to these cherished guests upon whom all the riches due to the long-suffering English, Scots, Welsh, Irish, and indeed the whole European working-class poor are being lavished. But the greatest reparation of all is their forced atonement to the goblins, 6 million of whom, they and their children as yet unborn, are accused of gassing in fake shower rooms, drowning in buckets, or flushing down latrines. Romulus and Remus read in a newspaper how a young man from the Eastern Realms had blown a large number of people up with a bomb. The article doted and fawned on a number of local indigenous British patrons of the boy's father's shop who expressed surprise at this really lovely young man could carry out such an act, given that he was so nice and helpful to the customers. He had even had a child by one of their daughters, though they said he was soon to marry a young woman from the East whom he had not yet even met. For their part, they told the journalist that they must respect the customs of these new Britons in return for their gifts of enriching diversity, and that the girl's half-caste child must remain without a father while she continued to live as his part-time mistress. Why this confused young English girl was even considering adopting the young terrorist's religion in the hope of one day becoming his second wife. In what world did they live? Romulus and Remus wondered, in which they did not realise that the relationship between the shopkeeper and public is always a courteous play. The same colonist who helps the old white lady lift her trolley in the door can express the deepest contempt for her behind her back. We could speak of the wonder of the young men at the many technologies driven into being by the demands of the occupiers in pursuit of progress, which had seized the attention of the Britons, to the point that they observed neither sky nor land nor stream nor river, but remained riveted on the small machines which communicated directly to them, the very poisons which were debilitating their minds and souls. But all this is well known to the majority of us. While passing through the once English city of London, they watched, on a television screen in a restaurant, some greasy, well-spoken goblin fiend, whose grandfather had been a spiv, selling unrationed sugar and tea from dark alleyways to the women whose husbands were dying at the front, at the call of his race, a pretender who had been educated at our most ancient and greatest seats of learning, and totally passable in the eyes of the innocent viewers as a native Briton, holding forth pompously on our racial inheritance. This hook-nosed devil lectured to his naive, self-hating British audience how Africans had always been central to our history, and in fact it was they who could claim ownership of our lands above any other. He provided scant proofs, but many presumptions, accusations of white guilt and inferences, the greatest being that he knew better than everyone else by simple virtue of his lofty position in the ivory towers of Academy, bestowed upon him over the heads of better men by intertribal nepotism and his innate superiority of Marxist morality over what he and the regime considered the ignorant, bigoted common folk. Whites who fancied that they were Britons, when in fact, he opined, Britain had always been a land of immigrants, and there was no such thing as the white race. This arrogant, rootless cosmopolitan academic, daring to speak as one of the most notable scholars on our past, not only did not reside in Britain himself, but in America. Not only that, but he held dual citizenship of another land, a nation whose people were also under illegal and injurious occupation by the goblins. What angered the boys most of all was how easily this ingratiating, self-confident and smug intruder dared to present himself by virtue of his parents' ability to buy station and class, as the very model of an English gentleman, speaking for England upon matters of her history, and doing so in terms of pure hatred for everything this blessed land, with its long-standing identity and its ancestored people, stood for. And we, the nationalist, patriotic sons of the soil of Britain, solemnly declare that both the presence of these goblins, who only entered our lands by purchase of mercenaries and traitors and against our will, as well as the iron grasp on the throat of our nation, which they now hold, is illegal, because the edict of expulsion of King Edward I still stands and has never been revoked. Nor legal is the presence on our soil of tens of millions of third world invaders, about whose import the British people have never been consulted, let alone allowed to vote upon, and have always opposed, whose entry into our land coincided with the implementation of draconian un-British laws to sustain their colonization, penalties composed for the oppression and suppression of our people and their replacement. This is no time for the faint-hearted pacifist with his selective version of Christ's teachings to go all woolly about the necessity for a huge, violent upheaval to undo the crimes of the past, for fear, out of Christian charity, of placing the occupiers and invaders in any stress by sending them home. Let those who see greater cause in allowing the cancer to kill the host than by taking scalpel to the lesion to be silent. Betake yourselves to your homes and pray, if you have no other contribution to make. And there will be no shame in you to follow the best callings of your conscience in taking such a course. Every drop of blood that is shed in the coming war is at the charge of the regime, which created the circumstance which led to a necessity for true patriots to rise up and save Britain from a certain and well-planned descent into a third-world hellhole, a vassal state of goblin tyranny and injustice, in which the wholesale slaughter of our people, the kulaks of today, at the incitement of the goblin media, will be its most popular sport. And let it be known that those on both sides who are cowards now will still be cowards in the war, and no threat to our resistance. Even the coward has his place. Be he of the other side, he will do no service to the enemy, and be quiet after the war for caution of us. And be he of our side, he may yet do great work for the cause, when not impeded by the threat or fear of the now defeated foe. In the immortal words of one comedian, we are not all Rob Roys.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.